Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's high noon on a long weekend. Thanks so much for tuning in to Nation Radio. We have Oilers stories of yesterday, today, and tomorrow, and major hockey news around the world. This is Alan Mitchell, Low Tide, joined by Connor Halley. Connor, how are you today?
Pretty good. How are you?
I'm very well. You're too young to remember this, but do you know what happened this day in 1984?
No.
Edmonton Oilers defeated the New York Islanders 5-2 to win the Stanley Cup in 84, their first. Dave Lumley centered the puck perfectly from way in his own end to finally make it 4-2, and that was it.
I should have known that.
Stanley number one for the Edmonton Oilers. And I'll tell you what, Stanley's 2, 3, 4, and 5 came along in pretty short order. Now, number six has been a sticky wicket, let's be honest. We have news on that. Obviously, the Oilers making a big coaching change this week, actually just not renewing Tom Rennie. We'll talk about that today. Our guests scheduled to appear are Jonathan Willis. We'll talk about, the coaching change and the possibility of a Sutter coming in. If you told me that in 1984, that a Sutter might be coach in the future, that would have been impossible. Bruce McCurdy will be by. We'll discuss the incredible Oil Kings run, these wacky World Hockey Championships, and the coming attractions in astronomy, because Bruce is a guy who knows that stuff. Tom Lynn, a player advisor, agent, and attorney certified by the National Hockey League Players Association. We've had him on before to talk a little bit about contracts and free agency. Today, we're going to focus specifically on the draft and teams as they start thinking about trades that they can make during the summertime. We'll have Tom on later in the show. Corey Pronman, quickly become a very credible source in regard to prospects. And we'll ask Corey the latest. We invite your emails as well today. Kent Simpson from the Oil Kings broadcast. What a crazy game that was last night. Holy moly. We'll talk about that with Kent and more throughout the day. And so let's get to it. The Oil Kings won a huge game last night. It had all kinds of controversy. And, you know, what I will remember most about that game is how quickly, after it was tied 3-3, the Oil Kings turned it into a 4-3 game and then held on. And, man, it was a wild ride. It puts Shawinigan in a huge hole because they lose game one. You've got St. John coming up as well, and then London. There's no easy game in this Memorial Cup this year. So full credit to the Oil Kings, who weren't as buttoned down in that game as they were against Portland, but man, that defense is wonderful. We'll talk about that today. I think the Oilers should just graduate the whole damn bunch of them to the NHL about, maybe 2015 or so, somewhere in there. Oil Kings rest until Monday. As you heard with the Pipeline guys, they're off today. They'll practice again tomorrow. And they'll play St. John with London the following day. So it gets very busy there. And really, if they win one of those games, the way it's going to work, I mean, St. John is so powerful. St. John could go through without a loss. So being 2-1 puts you in the catbird seat as it goes. So to make it to the final. So since everyone but the Sea Dogs is probably going to lose at least one game, you want to make sure you lose only the one if you're the Oil Kings. And obviously the London game is going to be huge. We'll talk about that with everybody, but specifically with Kent Simpson. That's going to be a big part of our story and our conversation with Kent today. The Edmonton Oilers announced this week that Tom Rennie won't be back. We've discussed Rennie's performance at length on this show, and I think there were reasons to keep him and reasons we can see why the Oilers did what they did on Thursday. I think the key will be his replacement, and both Terry Jones and Robin Brownlee believe it will be Brent Sutter. And in my experience, when two veteran guys like that, you know, Brownlee's been around a long time and Jones has been around before, you know, like Earth. So when those guys have that strong an indication and they write about it, that tells me that it's not a fait accompli or they would have announced it, but we're getting real close here. And Robin, as a matter of fact, mentioned that it probably before the first of the month, he suspects that might happen. So we might be talking about that this time next week as an actuality. Sutter, an experienced coach, I think the Oilers might be considering him as much because of his personality as his in-game management. He comes with that built-in Sutter crust, and then, he'd be well-known to both Kevin Lowe and Steve Tambellini from their playing years and obviously being around the National Hockey League for as long as he has. The Oilers may feel the team needs a kick in the ass more than an arm on the shoulder, and there's also a chance management would like a more aggressive style, and Sutter does coach that way. He likes to forecheck and force turnovers. numbers to get offense, and he likes rugged players, and I think that might benefit guys like Theo Peckham, Timo Hartikainen, and possibly Anton Lander as we move forward into training camp. But we're getting way ahead of ourselves because we still don't know who the coach for 2012-13 will be for the Edmonton Oilers. Joined now by, from the Cult of Hockey, Oilers Nation, NHL Numbers, and various other sites, Jonathan Willis. How are you today, man?
I'm doing great, Alan. How are you?
Good. You and I have talked a lot about Tom Rennie, and I think you and I were two of the few that sort of felt like maybe he should stay. Now that it's happened, do you think it's just a matter of the results weren't good enough in wins and losses?
Yeah, I really do think that the Oilers were trying to make a serious push starting this year, and they made up a lot of gap on their special teams and in terms of goal differential, but they didn't climb in the standings, and that's probably what cost Tom Rennie his job.
I would always say that he just didn't have the horses, and by that I mean Nikolai Habibulin had a great start, but he had really fumbled after that, and you can blame Tom Rennie for being a little hesitant to go with Dubnyk when he clearly earned the job, but then again, he's a young goaltender, and you've got a veteran too, and on the blue line there were some holes. We had talked about Whitney in the summer, last summer, you and I. You could argue he just didn't have the horses too.
I tend to agree with that. I think the one thing you can really fault Rennie for is his devotion to Habibulin. He went to Habibulin early. It paid off early, but then he stuck with him far longer than he should have. And that was something he did in 2010-11 as well. But beyond that, he wasn't in a great situation because he was tasked with developing the players and at the same time trying to win games. And this year I thought he did a fairly good job, but the way he was handling Ryan Nugent-Hopkins and Jordan Eberle, he was clearly had a big focus on development, and that probably hurt the team a little bit in the standings because he brought him along in baby steps, and Eberle probably didn't need it. Nugent-Hopkins responded well, I thought, but he might have been able to use those players more if he had been more focused on winning now and less on proper pace of development.
John, we talked when we teed off the show about the fact that Brent Sutter has been rumored, and Robin Brownlee and Terry Jones, pretty credible sources, have suggested it's a strong possibility. What do you think of Brent Sutter as a possible replacement for Tom Rennie for the Edmonton Oilers?
I don't have a problem with Brent Sutter. I don't know that he would be the guy I'd be really keyed in on, but he's got 5 years of coaching experience in the NHL now. He did fairly good work in New Jersey, fairly good work given the roster he had in Calgary. He does coach an aggressive team, like you said. He knows how to use, he's got something McTavish has in that he knows how to use spare parts that have some flaws. Like when Craig McTavish had Marc-Andre Bergeron, he got a lot out of a flawed player there. And that's something that Sutter's done in Calgary. I'm thinking specifically of Anton Babchuk last season. He got a lot out of him in his usage. I think he's a good coach. I think he'll be good for the Oilers. I don't know that he's the best available coach, but nobody's going to frown if the Oilers come away with Brent Sutter in terms of ability.
If it's Brent Sutter or really any coach, one of the main hurdles for the new coach is going to be finding a number one line that can really compete. Horkoff is a little long in the tooth, and he certainly was playing the tough opposition and getting the difficult zone starts. But I think if we're going to assess this reasonably, the Nuge is a little too young to take on that role. Do you think there's any possibility Sutter or whoever the new coach comes in and maybe tries Taylor Hall or Jordan Eberle at center?
I don't really see that as likely, no. Particularly not Eberle. Hall's been rumored as a potential center for a long time now, but between Horkoff and Gagne and Nugent-Hopkins, you've got to bump one of those guys to the wing if you're moving Hall to center. A lot's going to depend, too, on who they draft, what they end up doing at the draft, because there's still the possibility they come out of the draft with a center. But my expectation is that we see sort of what happened a few years ago with Mike Comrie. We knew after the Doug Weight trade that the Oilers didn't have a first-line center. Mike Comrie was the closest guy in the lineup in terms of delivering offensive numbers, so they used him. I think they'll use Nugent-Hopkins this year. I think Nugent-Hopkins is a better player now, even though he's younger than Comrie was when they tried it with Comrie. So my expectation is that Nugent-Hopkins gets the job up the middle, and that he runs with it.
Let's talk about the draft. Nail Yakupov is the consensus number one across the board player, and yet still we hear rumblings, and we don't know how credible they are, that the Oilers are, you know, possibly looking elsewhere or possibly looking to trade down. Do you think, you suggested in an article that you wrote a couple of days ago, the Oilers might be better to address defense with their second round pick?
Yeah, well, they've got two really good picks this year. That second round pick they have is the equivalent of a late first round pick. That's going to be a good player. It was a good player when they took David Musil. They've delivered quality, especially early in the second round so far. And if they want to address position, I'd rather see them do it a little later in the draft when the gap between the players available is pretty small. Like you can probably make a case when you're picking around that 30th overall mark that one a forward and a defenseman, if they're closely matched, that you should pick the guy that you think you need positionally long term, because there's not going to be a big gap between those two. I think at first overall, the consensus is so clear that Nail Yakupov is the best player in the draft that to take somebody else and retain that first overall pick would be a bit of a travesty.
One of the things that I've heard in terms of drafting Yakupov is as Hall insurance. Taylor Hall is I think we can agree, the most effective young player on this team, but he does have a tendency to get injured, you know, twice in 2 years for the Oilers. Yakupov, despite his knee injury up until then, had been a little bit more durable. What do you think about that as a kind of an elite winger, you know, insurance against Taylor Hall, maybe turning into kind of a Wendell Clark career where he's playing 45 to 50 games a year?
I understand the sentiment. My own personal opinion is we don't know what Yakupov's going to be. Three years ago, I mean, Taylor Hall, when they drafted Taylor Hall, the team was all about Taylor Hall. And the first overall pick that turned out to be Nugent Hopkins, I mean, you'll recall around the draft at that time, a lot of people said, well, we could trade it for help. We could trade down. We could do this, that, or the other thing with it. The Oilers picked Nugent Hopkins. Now, a year later, we're saying, well, Nugent Hopkins, I mean, you look at the numbers he put up as a rookie, it's more impressive than whatever Taylor Hall did. He might end up being the best of those three players, and nobody in their right mind is talking about trading him now. So a year from now, if the Oilers take Yakupov, we might be saying, well, Yakupov's the best of the bunch. Look at what he did as a rookie. He's incredible. It's that first NHL season, once they get through, these guys, at least in the Oilers' experience, have had more value. Eberle, after his first year as a rookie, had more value. The same thing with Hall, the same thing with Nugent Hopkins, because we identified these players. We could really see them as part of the future because they delivered in that first year. So if Yakupov delivers in that first year, we might be talking about him as the best of the group. I don't think we will, because those are very good players. But, I mean, when Scotty Bowman compares a guy to Pavel Bure, you have to listen to that.
In watching Oil Change, which is a great show, I'm hoping they roll out some draft stuff. They did a great job, I thought, in the Taylor Hall year, and maybe lacked the same kind of intensity on Oil Change during 2011. The defense has always been a topic of discussion during those shows. I remember specifically Stu McGregor talking about not passing on Marinchin when they got Pitlick, and then they ended up making a trade to get him later in that round, in number two, in 2010. If the Oilers think this is their last best chance to get an impact foundation defenseman in, you know, and I'll use Ryan Murray as an example, and the scouts are saying, you know, this is your guy, can you at least understand why they would possibly do that based on their roster? Or do you think that would be like a cardinal sin of drafting to take Murray or to trade down to get Ryan Murray?
I can understand the sentiment. And if they were to trade down and they were to acquire something else, and then they took Ryan Murray at third overall or second overall, I would understand it. It wouldn't be what I would do, but I would understand it. I think taking Ryan Murray first overall would be a big mistake. And the real problem with drafting Murray here is, first of all, there's Murray's skill set. He's acknowledged as the most NHL-ready defenseman in the draft, and most people, aside from a few Dumba diehards, will acknowledge him as the best defenseman, period, in the draft. But he's the kind of guy that people aren't really projecting to be a Drew Doughty type. There's not the same buzz as there has been with previous highly touted defensemen. Just the verbal on him reminds me a lot of what people were saying about Jay Bouwmeester the year he went third overall. Mm-hmm. This is a guy who's probably not going to put up major minutes. If you're looking for an elite Norris Trophy winning defenseman, there seems to be a lot of doubt that this guy is ever going to be that guy. He'll be a very good NHL player, but he's not going to be that. And the second issue is timelines. You draft a defenseman now, he's younger than the forward core you have, and we know defensemen take longer to develop. We know there's a lot of responsibility involved in that position. We look at a team like Chicago, their defensemen were all older than their core forwards. So I think if you're trying to address the defense through the draft at the expense of a guy like Yakupov, it's a bad decision.
In conversation with Jonathan Willis from Cult of Hockey, Oilers Nation, and NHL Numbers. Jonathan, are you getting a lot of flack because, once again, I'm kicking you in the ass in the Oilers Nation hockey pool, or is that kind of slackened off this year?
I think we all just expect you to win, Alan. I was listening to the start of the show, and you're telling Connor, you know, you're too young to remember this. I'm trying to think. You've probably said that three or four times to me, so you've got all these years of experience. How are we supposed to compete with that?
Yeah. Although, you know what? As you get older, you realize how, when I was 20, I started to realize what an idiot I was when I was, 10, and then it just continues. So when you get to be 50, you're like, man, I was stupid right up until now. And I imagine when I'm 60, it'll be pretty much the same. You're doing some work at NHL Numbers. Tell me a little bit about that experience for you. And I've been very impressed with reading so far. We're really getting into the background stuff and coming up with some great articles that maybe are not mainstream, but really open the mind, and we start to look at some really tough to figure out problems.
Yeah, there's been some great stuff there. And the cast at NHL Numbers is incredible. I've been talking by email a little bit, and hopefully I'm not spilling anything here with Gabe Desjardins, and he's got some great stuff coming. Of course, he's the guy from Behind the Net who's really done a huge amount of work making this stuff accessible to people like you and me. And just the number of smart people there, I kind of feel a little dumb sometimes when I look at the guys that are writing there now and that will be writing there in the future. I think it's a great chance to do something interesting, to shift the conversation a little bit on hockey to something that has a little less storytelling maybe, and just a little more rational, getting to what's really happening and proving it, and getting away a little bit from some of the conventional wisdom and some of the narratives that we cling to.
You know, you think you feel stupid doing that. I walk in there with a slide rule and an adiator, so I've got I'm like several generations away from where you are. What can we look forward to from you, Cult of Hockey, Oilers Nation, NHL Numbers, and in your other spots in the next week or so?
Well, I'm going to be, I know we've been talking about Brent Sutter being the presumptive coach of the Oilers. I'm going to look at some of the other guys they might be considering. I've done some of that already, but I haven't looked at people like Ralph Kruger, for example. So I'll be doing that, and hopefully getting into some of the big decisions that have shaped the Oilers from a few years ago, and just looking back at what the options were and what they decided to do, and looking at how it's turned out. Beyond that, I've got a bulletin board on my right here with about 20 things that I could pick at, but just see what happens.
Well, I'm enjoying your very balanced, I think, reporting on Steve Tambellini, and the fact that, you know, it's very easy when a team has finished 30th, and 29th to jump all over management. I thought you've done a very nice job of being very balanced and fair about, just going back and assessing that and pointing out the positives in what has been a difficult time. But, you know, you can see light at the end of the tunnel.
Well, that's the thing with Tambellini's tenure. It's not a black and white judgment call. I haven't been a fan of everything he's done, but he has done quite a few things that are going to benefit the Oilers in the long haul. And I just think it's important that we recognize both what he's done right and what I would argue he's done wrong.
Jonathan, thanks for this. Appreciate it very much.
Thanks for having me on the show. It's always a pleasure.
All right. That's Jonathan Willis from, as we mentioned, Cult of Hockey, Oilers Nation, NHL Numbers, and a real bright guy. And I look forward to talking to him again as we get towards the draft and free agency as well. Now, this is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors. On the way, we're going to talk to Tom Lynn, player advisor, agent, and attorney. We're specifically going to get into what NHL teams do leading up to, in preparation for the draft and for trades as well. And we'll talk to him on the way next.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's 12:26, 0-0 between the Rangers and New Jersey. What is it about afternoon hockey? I mean, I'm like, fine, but could you, like, play it at like 5 o'clock my time or 8 o'clock my time, because that's when I'm in the mood to watch a hockey game on a Saturday night. I know it's the long, May long weekend. We're all relaxed, but it's hard to get, you know, it's, you got yard work and stuff to do and shopping. Anyway, bitch and moan. By the way, we had the Oil Kings at Shawinigan last night, and that was a great game, a classic. And we'll talk to Ken Simpson about that later on. That was a great game, man, you know, and a crazy call, and then they give up another goal, and I feel bad for Keegan Lowe, because, you know, that guy is a really good defenseman. For that play to, you know, for him to overskate the puck, the ice must be dreadful. We'll find out exactly how dreadful with Kent later on in the show. But the rush play at Rochester, 5:30 tonight, right here on Team 1260 with Jason Greger. That's a huge, massive game. And obviously, we're thrilled to have it right here on Team 1260 Radio. So a couple things we want to get to here before we go to Tom Lynn, player, agent, advisor, and attorney. Just a few things, comments today that are coming up, some really good ones in regard to the possibility of Sutter becoming the coach. And then I had also mentioned that, you know, I thought that maybe Taylor Hall should move from left wing to center. So Semenko and Troy posted at Oilers Nation, moving a strong-willed, powerful, and dynamic center skater from wing to center seemed to work for us a few years ago. Having a duo of Hall Eberle pushing the play and drawing the opposition's best defenseman should create uber opportunity for the Nuge and Yakupov against second pairings. It's easier to find develop complementary wingers for those combinations with Hall at center. I thought that was interesting. Now, there are some people who disagree with me. Stefan says, with all due respect, Eberle is our best player. I would put Taylor Hall at number three behind Eberle in the Nuge. Taylor Hall plays with his head down and gets torpedoed way too often, lacks the mental calmness that Eberle displays day in and day out. Hall needs to slow down at times and use his speed when needed, not full balls out the entire time. So, you know, Rennie is the fall. This is from Fight Club. Rennie is the fall guy for Tambellini's incompetence. How many bad deals does he have to make before it's obvious that he's the problem? He's picked a disastrous coach, worthless free agents, and made horrific trades. Well, Fight Club, if you could just get out there how you really feel. I do believe, and there's been a lot of reporting on it, Terry Jones, Mark Spector, several others, and I can't think right now, and I apologize for missing the name, but there's been some reporting in both newspapers that has been quite critical of Steve Tambellini, the way it happened in terms of not letting Tom Rennie know, and then also saying, you know, hey, the pressure is on right now in a big way, because, you know, Pat Quinn, you know, firing Craig McTavish, then bringing in Pat Quinn, that didn't work out. Tom Rennie, who I think we could all agree move the ball forward at some level. The NHL Oilers are better now than when Tom Rennie arrived, and certainly than you know, the days that J.F. Jacques was playing left wing with Horkoff and Hemsky under the Pat Quinn regime. So, you know, there's that. And then Steve Tambellini, a little bit under pressure now, because whoever he chooses for coach, and I think that's one of the reasons they didn't announce it right away that it was Sutter. I think there's some due diligence still to go on to see if any of these other guys shake loose. It looks like McClellan in San Jose will be staying. So that's a possibility, too. So I think that Steve Tambellini is under a lot of pressure, and I think that at some level anyway, the Edmonton Oilers are going to be very, very careful about choosing their next coach, and Steve Tambellini specifically probably hiring his last coach. That's just my opinion, but, you know, it's going to have to be a good one. My honest opinion is I can't see the Edmonton Oilers, with as much talent as they have on the ice right now, I cannot see them finishing anywhere near 29th, and that involves obviously getting some things done on defense, making sure you're covered in goal, just in case Nikolai Habibulin has done that, you know, late 30s, early 40s slide into the abyss. And I mean, it's nothing against Nikolai Habibulin. He's just got a lot of miles on him as a goaltender, and that's what happens when you're a certain age. And the contract, you know, looks like it was 1 or 2 years too long for Nikolai Habibulin. Some would say 4, but, you know, you get my drift. And so, for the Edmonton Oilers, as long as they can do those things with Taylor Hall and the Nuge and Jordan Eberle and Sam Gagner and all those other guys up front, and if Ryan Whitney can come back healthy, that's a question mark. But they should be much better just based on the talent they have now, even aside from adding Neil Yakupov, which is a big, big, big item. And possibly if you don't draft him, you trade down, get Ryan Murray, and add another asset. It's 12:31. We're joined on the line by Tom Lynn, player, advisor, agent, and attorney. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing well. It's too hot down here. We set a record for heat, but other than that, it's hockey weather.
Where are you?
I'm actually in Chicago for the USHL Combine, but the whole Midwest is under a heat wave.
So for someone like you, an executive, agent, that sort of thing, the off season is busier than the regular season.
Yeah, it's funny how the rhythm goes. In the NHL for so many years, you had your schedule mapped out. You could buy plane tickets because you had July 1 free agency, and then arbitrations from July 20 to August 3rd, and you had the June 1 signing deadline for draft picks, the trade deadline at Christmas, and then kind of through the season, you knew when your busy times were. On the advisor and agency side, it's basically geared around tournaments and combines and stuff like that.
And the Hlinka starts, what, in August?
Yes.
So for scouts, it really is. You know, the draft's late June, and somebody's got to go over there and check out those kids at the Hlinka, and that's just a few weeks later.
Right. I mean, the amateur guys now are really squeezed because they basically get July off to a degree, but you got the camps, the Canada and U.S. national camps start first week in August, and then you've got to go over to Europe for a couple tournaments, and then you're into the training camps.
Crazy. I want to talk a little bit about the NHL teams leading up to the draft and how they prepare. And I'm not going to use the Oilers as an example, but it's an easy one that we can all follow. Say they want to add a solid quality veteran defenseman during the summer. They would have already obviously done their due diligence with the pro scouts and come up with a name. You know, Garrison's a free agent. Tootin's available, that sort of thing. At what point do they begin, after they've done their due diligence and found the information, what point do they begin a conversation with the other team on a specific player?
Now, that's a good question, because there's a scientific question of preparation, which I think a lot of teams do similarly as far as their scouting, gathering information. When you have the kind of May-June pro scouting meetings, you make those decisions. And the style side, which is really up to the GM, is another thing entirely. Some GMs like to make a lot of calls, throw information out there, try to figure out what's going on and gather information. Other ones, you know, like your classic slats in New York, keeps everything close to the vest, you know, and might jump you with a deal at the last second, but you don't know what he's thinking. Other GMs say, hey, I need X, Y, and Z. I'm giving up S, and if you're interested, call me. So the style there is so different that you never knew what a guy was going to come up with.
Whitey Herzog always said that he never mentioned the guy he wanted until the last minute. He would say, I want this guy. Well, you know what? What about that guy? And then that's right. The guy he wanted, which is crazy, but, I mean, it worked for Whitey.
Yeah, and, you know, some guys do that, and other people get to know it right away. And so the person they mention right at the last minute, they either think is the guy they really wanted or a guy they should keep. And I remember the story of Bobby Clark, and we were talking about trading for a player there, and we went on, and finally my boss said at the end, I'd like this player in the trade, and Bobby said, well, I'm not giving him up. And Doug said, why not? Because you want him. And Bobby didn't know who he was, but he knew we had a good scouting staff at the Wild. It was back in 2002. It was Eric Chouinard we were talking about.
Oh, okay.
And the player we mentioned before his name, Bobby said, I'm not giving up because you want him. So it's going to your point that some people are onto that.
When you were in Minnesota, how much of the actual truth made it to the media, to the mainstream media? I'm talking about national, but also local.
Well, as far as truth, I don't think there was a lot of sense of lies or something like that out there. But as far as, you know, the team reporting what they wanted, in a general sense, we were often pretty honest, you know, saying we need to be more physical on defense and we need a backup goalie. You know, that would be pretty honest. But as far as putting names or actual decision-making out there, you just couldn't do it, you know, simply because it would ruin what you were trying to do.
Right.
You can't do that type of thing publicly. A lot of people are analyzing it. When we're sitting down analyzing the other teams, partially by their depth charts, but also the NHL sends out the clips every day at every single team, and most teams have someone in the office go through all the teams and try to pick out stuff. So if a GM, say in Calgary, says, I'm really angry at Joe Smith, then, you know, we kind of note that, you know, or the coach or anyone else. So you're gathering that information. You don't want to put out there that we like player X better than player Y, because it can only be used against you. Kind of like the Miranda warnings here in the United States. Anything anything you say can and will be used against you.
There you go.
So most of what you see out there is strategic. Once in a while, you have a person who speaks his mind. I don't think it necessarily benefits them. The press loves it. Like, they loved when Brett Hull was a GM. But it probably wasn't the best thing for the Dallas Stars.
Yeah, and it's funny because the major story this summer, and we'll get to the draft in a second, but is the story of the two Russians, you know, in Nashville, curfew and then not playing, and it's sort of divisive because Don Cherry says that, you know, they should have played him. Then I've heard a lot of people NHL people say, no, that was a great call, right thing to do. Does that get noticed too? Like if you're a small market team, and I'll just use Columbus as an example, and you're interested in a player, and you think he might be a little devalued by the rest of the league, does that perk up your ears? Is that something you make a note of as well?
Yeah, I mean, I think everyone tries to do that, but some teams are better than others, and some teams will take more risks than others. So in our circumstance with the Wild, I can remember players that we acquired who we knew had drug and alcohol histories in particular. But if they'd taken steps to address it, we figured, well, here's a guy who's undervalued because he struggled for 3 years, and you know now he's on the straight and narrow. He might come to the fore. Other guys had some other behavioral issues, like a Patrick O'Sullivan, who we looked into and decided it wasn't valid, what he had going on. Mm-hmm. And so we tried to do that. Many teams will say they do it but don't want to take any risks. Other teams will go overboard. As you've seen, I probably won't mention them on the radio, but some teams have taken on too much baggage, hoping that, we got four guys with baggage, and sometimes they don't play hard, and sometimes they get in trouble off the ice. And that can be the wrong way to do it as well. You want your core not to include those guys, but you can sometimes get better by bringing them in.
In conversation with Tom Lynn, player, advisor, agent, and attorney, the Oilers are in a situation. I think there's a possibility, and I'm reading tea leaves here, so bear with me. But they're in a bit of a sticky wicket now. The number one consensus overall pick is a Russian with great skill, maybe a knee right. concern, but a guy who is clearly number one. They have a massive need for a defenseman of the future, a foundation defenseman, and they may feel, I don't know that they do, but they may feel like Ryan Murray's the guy. And yet you've got Columbus right behind them who, may want that defenseman too. And the fan base is looking at it and going, hey, we need more offense. Let's grab that guy. Is that the kind of thing, in an overview, I'm not asking you to speak specifically to that issue, but do organizations find themselves somewhat trapped? The winning the lottery hurt or hinder or could possibly hurt or hinder the Oilers because they were already devoted to that one player?
That's a good question, because it all depends upon how much GM or management are willing to do what they see as right rather than what's expedient, politically short term. We got to remember that with very few exceptions, and I'm probably thinking like 5 to 7 exceptions since the lockout, a player has not come in the year after being drafted and made an impact. And by impact, I mean made his team better. There are a number of teams that made teams, but Marin Gabber came in and scored 18 goals his first year. We're all excited because he's 18. But if I told you, we signed a 34-year-old who came in and scored 18 goals, what's the difference, you'd say?
Right.
So for a player to actually come in, an elite player at that level, and make his team better generally takes 2 to 4 years, with a defenseman being on the longer side, because it takes longer to learn the position. Mm-hmm. So they've got to understand that as well and think, all right, are we going to think reality here and realize that our scoring woes won't be affected for at least 2 years by offensive pick, and our defense may not be helped for 3 to 4 years by a defensive pick? Fans and media be damned, who are expecting to connect those dots. That's how a team really has to approach it and look at it realistically. Once in a while you see Sidney Crosby, Ovechkin come down, you realize he'll step in earlier. I don't think that's the case here, and I don't think the conventional wisdom is the case that anyone in the top five is going to make their team better next year and possibly not the year after. But you're looking 3 seasons out for these guys to really make their team better.
Right. A couple of CBA questions to before we let you go, and I appreciate your time, Tom. Should we be concerned as fans that the two sides are acting like Joe Cool here, no negotiations, we're now into the later spring? Or is this, do you feel, the type of negotiation that could go quickly because both sides don't want to lose another year?
Yeah, I mean, I have no negative connotations coming from the lack of bargaining right now, because most of the bargaining gets done at the last minute, one. Number two, the history of at least one side of this debate has a history of doing all the bargaining at the last minute. Some people feel, and usually not at the table, some people feel, well, you should start talking early so you can get all the issues out and know what they are and everything else, even if you resolve them at the last minute. However, I don't know if that's the case. I think both sides know what their issues are. They have teams of lawyers on either side of analyzed everything and gone to their constituencies. What's really happening, I think, in a nutshell, is Don Fehr realizing that I should learn more from my players, agents, staff, and all that for as long as possible, because the NHL traditionally doesn't move or really do anything in bargaining until the last minute. So if I'm going to spend 20 hours today working, I should work on my side rather than the other side.
Right.
So it doesn't mean anything as far as what gets done or doesn't get done.
One of the really thoughtful interviews and discussions I've read in the last several years was from Billy Guerin. He was quoted a while back saying basically that he lost a year and his generation of players lost a year, it impacted them, and he didn't feel like it was worth it, and he was passing it along to the next generation. Do you think that sort of thing from a respected veteran might have some sustain, or do you think the bad blood is still there from the previous negotiations and that will carry the day?
Well, first, if there's a thoughtful interview with Billy Guerin, I want you to send me the link. that would be tremendous. it was tough as an American to cheer for those teams for so many years. It was difficult, when they went to Japan and trashed rooms and spoke out in the media and called our game a sucky game and all that. So that was tough. But as far as the point, which is a veteran saying, let's not go too far, geez, it's too early to tell because nothing's shaped up yet. I don't think anyone's thinking about Armageddon right now. Mm-hmm. They're thinking about their smaller issues, limits on contracts and trades and that type of thing. No one's thinking big time. I think quotes like that and pressure like that from influential figures in the game would be more relevant to the players' and owners' minds, come October 1 or, as things start to really get down to it.
That's great information. Tom, thanks so much. Appreciate it.
No problem.
All right. Tom Lynn, player advisor, agent, and attorney. Interesting guy. And you know what? I get so many questions from him. I hope I covered most of them. I've got a couple folks who've asked if they can email him stuff, and we'll talk later about that because he's the one guest that I think that everybody has a question for because it's such a unique situation. He's been on both sides of he's been obviously an assistant GM and GM in Minnesota, a player agent, and he has great, great answers. But some of the questions are kind of long for radio, so I hope you appreciate that, and we'll do our best to hook you up with him. And, he's very generous with his time, certainly with us anyway, and we appreciate it. Now, we got a very busy rest of the show. Bruce McCurdy from Cult of Hockey is going to be on. We're going to talk Oil Kings World Hockey Championships and obviously about the Rennie changeover. And we also have Kent Simpson and Corey Pronman on the way before 2 o'clock today. So stay tuned. This is Nation Radio brought to you by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
After two, it's the Rangers and New Jersey. No score. I can't believe the Rangers aren't dominating that. I don't watch New Jersey that much because of my Lou Lamoriello, attitude towards Lou. But are they that good? Is this just smoke and mirrors? Has Brodeur made a comeback? What's going on? I need to know because I thought both series would be over in four or five. That was my belief. I thought LA was really strong. And that I thought the New York Rangers, in fact, I want the Kings to win as a fan because they've never won the Stanley Cup before. I like the underdog. I would like all teams that haven't won the Stanley Cup, unless it's the Oilers. And then, the Oilers can win as many as they want. But everybody else, I think Los Angeles should win this year. And then next year, it could be another team that's never won before. That's my feeling. Russia beat Finland 6-2, and the Slovaks beat the Czechs 3-1. So it's going to be Russia and Slovakia tomorrow. Interesting game. Chara will play 73 minutes tomorrow. He'll play both sides of defense. That's going to be a great game. And that'll be on like at 2 in the morning or some darn thing. But and of course, the LA Kings-Phoenix game series could wrap up tomorrow. And then they'll probably have to wait a week or so for the other series to get. And that's what happened to the Oilers. Remember that in games when they won in the West and then the NHL, because it's the NHL, the Oilers waited like maybe 10 days. It was a long layoff, as I recall, and that impacted them in a big way. And that's one of the reasons they lost, as well as the Bergeron play. But we won't talk about that. It's 12:50, 10 minutes before 1 o'clock. This is Nation Radio. I'm Alan Mitchell. We're joined by Corey Pronman from Hockey Perspectives. How are you today, sir?
I'm doing great, Alan. Thanks for having me on.
How many Twitter questions do you answer in a week there, buddy?
Depends on the week, but as we get closer to draft time, it's going to get increasingly higher as the days go by.
Well, I like the fact that you answer the questions, and I appreciate that. Your top 100 is up. It looks rock solid. The reads are very good. When do you start working on the 2013 list? Is this a year-round thing, or do you take a few months off in the summer and then go for it again?
Months off, that's not me. 2013, I kind of like start taking preliminary notes throughout the year. I watched some games at the Under-17 Challenge. That was a major 2013 event. At the World Under-18, there's a lot of good 2013 players there. So right around now, I'm starting to get a little more serious about this. And once the draft is done in June, then I'm going to really start getting all my 2013 homework done.
Okay, sounds good. Let's start talking about the 2012 draft now. In your opinion, how large is the gap between Neil Yakupov and the number two man in the draft?
Well, my number two man is Mikhail Grigorenko. He's a guy I am very high on. I know, I would say, just talking to a ton of scouts, but the industry consensus is that Yakupov is the clear, in a way, number one pick. But in my opinion, Grigorenko is kind of like a 1B to him.
Okay.
I would say coming into the draft...
That's what you call a cliffhanger. In radio parlance, that's a cliffhanger. I would say coming into the draft, and then, you know, it's crickets. Now, we'll get Corey back because we got lots of questions about number one overall. We're going to get into the Ryan Murray conversation, and we're going to talk about Europe as well, the late surges up the charts. Somebody asked the other day about the fact that it seems as though the European kids are ranked like 50th or 35th, and then they zoom up late in the year or even into the off season. And I think a lot of that has to do with the combine and reporting, but we'll talk with Corey because he follows us a lot closer, and we've got some email and Twitter questions for him as well. So we want to touch base on those. As we get closer to the draft, we'll have Corey on. We're hoping to get somebody from ISS as well, as many sources as we possibly can to give you information on the draft. Remember last year we had Craig Button. We can never get Craig because of timing and all that now, but we're gonna have Corey and a few others. I'm hoping to get Michael Spadell, who you might know as Speeds. He always does really great draft work, so a few of the Copper and Blue guys as well as we get closer to the draft. What we're looking for, basically, is an overall view. Not everybody's going to agree, but the bottom line is we want to, by the time the draft comes and the pipeline guys take over on draft night, you'll know a little bit of the background about the top 10, 15, and then a few guys like Samuelson, who you might be seeing for the Oil Kings play right now, who should be players that we can, you know, maybe look at for the second round. As fans, I think it's easier to follow a draft after it happens because you just don't have the kind of information or time to grab them all. I know ISS does a top 100. They do very well. Corey at Hockey Prospectus does a great job too. But what we look forward to is getting all the information in. And Connor, did we get Corey back or no?
His phone's not working. I don't know.
Okay. So, Connor, can you tell me a little bit about the gap between Neil Yakupov and number two on your list?
Yes, I can.
All right. You know what, Corey? I think this is twice now. His phone's... We're going to get him a phone because he's a very valuable guy. He's got great information, and unfortunately, we're not going to be able to spend some time with him today, which is, you know, as I mentioned, very unfortunate. We can talk a little bit about the Oklahoma City Barons, who were drubbed 5-1 in game number one against the Toronto Marlies, and that was in Oklahoma City. Game number two, they came back and won again. And it's interesting because the prospects that the new coach for the Edmonton Oilers is going to want to pay attention to are guys like Magnus Pajärvi, who had a big game, and then we also had Timo Hartikainen have a big game there too. And those are some bigger kids. Pajärvi with speed and Hartikainen with that ability to battle down low and really take care of business. So those are really good signs, really, really good signs. And Corey's back. How you doing, buddy? Corey?
Yeah.
Good man. What plan are you on?
I don't know. I'm on Verizon. I do a couple of radio shows, and you're the only one I ever have trouble with.
Well, you know, we got this big damn tower, Corey. It's not our fault.
Okay, yeah. I'm going to get a landline next time.
Okay, don't worry about it. Okay, you were talking about the gap between number one and two, and I was going to follow up and ask you about the fact that there's a great deal of variance on these lists, Button to McKenzie and on and on. After number one, it kind of goes all over. Is that unusual?
No, not really. I would say at the top, being number one, number two, that would be unusual. But I mean, I've had the privilege of seeing a few teams' draft boards or part of their draft boards, and you should see how the top some teams' list look. I would say usually there's a consensus one or two talents, and after that, if a talent gap gets closed at all, then people start going all over the place to the personal preference on NHL teams' boards. So when you're talking about those independent lists or people who do them, or when McKenzie basically gets an aggregate list, that's not abnormal at all to see a lot of variance at the top.
I've been following the draft for years now, and in the last several years or so, the European kids make late surges. I mean, after the season is over, is that a combine thing or just getting the information in? I know you do a good job of slotting the Europeans early, but it seems like we get late information on these kids, and I'll use Klefbom from last year as an example.
Well, the thing with the Europeans are is it's much, much easier to get information on people who play in the CHL, for example, than those who play in the Swedish Junior League. And the people who make the list usually, or people who make decisions more precisely, are those usually based in North America. Now, there are a couple of major international events you can see throughout the year. Now, there's Holinka in the summer. There's international tournaments in November and February, and the under 18 in the spring, as well as World Juniors around Christmas time. But the thing is, when you live in North America, you're going to see players regularly play and see how they develop over the course of the year. If you don't live in Europe, you only have those select events to see for yourself how these players are progressing.
Right.
You might hear stuff from your European scouts, but really, a player may only look okay in the summer and in November, and his development goes well. He has a big second half. But you don't really see that until April when you actually get the first time you see him during that second half.
Let's do some quick hits here before we let you go. Tell me about Hampus Lundholm and what we can expect from him.
Well, it's funny that I've heard of a lot of comparisons. I mean, I don't really like comparisons anyway, but for people I've talked to in the industry, to Oilers' first pick last year, which was Klefbom.
Okay.
And he's not, I wouldn't say the perfect comparisons, but they're both a big Swedish D-man, who are high-end skaters, have offensive ability. I'd say Lindholm, though, are not as physical, although he still has a decent physical game, than Klefbom, and has a little more offensive potential. He really came on the second half. I saw him back right before Christmas, and he only looked like average-ish. But down the stretch, especially the under-18, he just shone. And he's a very gifted, big, skilled D-man, and he's definitely going to go in the middle of the first round.
What about Callie Anderson?
Kyle Anderson was the number 3 D-man for Sweden at international events. Decent-sized, pro-sized D-man, good puck skills, good puck mover, very offensively gifted. I wouldn't say he's a finished product, but when you take the fact that he has the size and he has the offensive abilities, that's going to be intrigued teams enough that he's for sure going to go in the second round. And I wouldn't be surprised at all if he went in the top 40.
And Jimmy Vesey?
Jimmy Vesey was undrafted last year, then just had an amazing year in the EJHL this season. Very good puck skills, good hockey sense. I really like his potential as an offensive sleeper. He has scored upside in my opinion. His frame's still a little thin, and his skating's only okay, but not as bad as his father was. And he's a guy I think for sure going to get drafted this year. And if a team has really done their research on him, they might go and take him a little higher than some people expect.
And Matt Finn.
Matt Finn was a guy who really progressed since last year. When I talked to scouts last year, they saw him as a safe, defensive defenseman, not really a lot of flash, and then he has burst onto the scene this year. Always had high-end hockey sense, but it was translating at both ends this year. Skating went from below average to arguably above average in a very short amount of time. Very well-rounded defenseman. Physical game's a bit of a concern just because he's kind of a little short and really just like basically just really skinny frame. But you got to love the puck skills. Amazing puck mover, good skater, a really good offensive package there.
Final one, and this is from Kevin Jameson, asking about Morgan Riley.
Morgan Riley, again, was a guy, he who missed most of the year due to a knee injury. And you kind of worry about his skating when that happened because he was a high-end skater prior to the injury. Although when he came back briefly for the WHL playoffs, skating looked just as good as it did beforehand. Tremendous passer, tremendous puck handler, just a really high-end across the board. I talked to some scouts early in the year who thought he had the potential to be the top D-man taken in this draft ahead of Ryan Murray and Matt Dumba, just based on his pure offensive upside, although I don't think any team will do that based on the fact that he was injured all year, and it's at least a close call between him and the other two options. Defensively, you worry a little bit because it's not only did he get injured, but he's a small guy, not really that physically gifted, really not that strong. So you worry how he's going to do it on his own end, but offensively, he's as good as they come in the draft.
Corey, where can we read you?
You can read me on Hockey Perspective. I have my top 100 draft process coming out right now. kind of reports on all 100 coming out, explanations on the top 20, and I also will be doing top 10 prospect reports on each system later in the summer.
Corey, thanks for this. Have a great great weekend.
You too, Alan.
All right. Corey Pronman from Hockey Prospectus. Connor. You know, Corey mentioned that his phone works fine on all the other radio stations, and yet it doesn't work fine here. What's the problem?
He's trying to find a way to put this on me, hey?
Oh, I'm just saying, you know, that, and I know I listen to the team all the time, and all the other shows have good phones.
I don't want to call Corey a liar, but...
Well, I'm just saying, you know, like, I come in here on Saturday, and I do preparation. You can see this is written down on paper. And Corey's got a good phone, as he told us he did. And then, you know, the phone doesn't come on.
Corey's the only person that doesn't work for me, so...
Well, I'm just saying.
Maybe versus him, who are you
know, Jason Gregor doesn't have these problems. You know, these big stars.
Allison Curry is just
Dustin
dynamic.
Nielsen.
What can I say?
Allison Curry. Now, is she good?
Shout out.
You know, I'm just saying, you know. I'm not threatening you. I'm just asking, you know. I'm just teasing,
I'm
Connor.
Out of here.
All right. Okay. This is Nation Radio. We're going to be talking to Kent Simpson and Bruce McCurdy in the next half hour. Brought to you by Edmonton Motors. We're back.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
It's 8 minutes after 1 o'clock. This is Nation Radio. We're around until 2 o'clock today. Busy afternoon. We got Jungle Jim Hunter on at 2 o'clock, and then at 4, it's my good friend Jeff Crichel. And at 5:30 today, right here, championship NLL game. Rochester, Rush, and Jason Gregor will call the game on Team 1260. And you know what? That's huge. Looking forward to it. And you know what? The Rush have, they really have. It's funny. Edmonton sports franchises, Rush, and I'll include the Oil Kings in that, and FC as well, are really starting to show up, and it's good to see. And the Oilers are, you know, I think hopefully going to get inspiration from, I think, the Oil Kings, because, you know, you see the template, you see how it's done, an opportunity to, you know, with a new coach and another, you know, top draft pick, a couple of years, Edmonton Oilers could be rocking this town. That's all I'm saying. All right. Coming up in this hour, we're going to talk to Ken Simpson, Oil Kings color commentator on our broadcast on Team 1260, and Bruce McCurdy from the Cult of Hockey about various things going on. Bruce will talk about astronomy, the World Hockey Championships, and, of course, the possibility of Brent Sutter being the next coach of the Edmonton Oilers. Oil Kings, of course, won a huge game last night in and against Shawinigan, a round robin like the Memorial Cup. Losing game one is a just an absolutely diabolical thing to overcome. So it's a big victory. And we're joined now by Ken Simpson. Ken, how are you today?
Great, Al. How are you?
Good. Let's start with the controversial play, because I obviously, listening to the booth and then listening to the referee, it sounds to me like it was simply an error. I mean, it just the saddest thing ever, but just a misinformation and miscommunication. It shouldn't have been a goal, and it counted. But you've got to appreciate how the Oil Kings came back after that.
Oh, no question. And I think probably the best thing was that the Oil Kings at the time wouldn't have known the process. You know, obviously the people watching at home had the luxury of seeing the view. You know, even for Corey and myself, we actually had the screen, the feed from Sportsnet right in front of us, but of course we couldn't hear it. So everything that we saw was just, we just assumed that the message from the video replay was, hey, it's a good goal, call it a goal, and carry on. So I'm sure that's probably what the feeling was on the Oil Kings bench. The referee came and explained to Derek Laxtal, and so it wasn't until after the game that you know, they kind of started to blow up that, whoa, wait a second, that actually wasn't the message from the video judge. So from an Oil Kings perspective, I think hey, they had a 2-goal lead. It was suddenly 3-2, and they had to just keep playing and worrying about holding their lead.
I guess the thing that was maybe even more impactful of the Oil Kings was the ice. I Keegan Lowe is a, you know, I mean, he's a seasoned WHL, CHL defenseman. He doesn't make that mistake unless the ice is pretty choppy, right?
Oh, for sure. And I mean, you know, that was something that was, you know, throughout the whole game, you know, guys were skating over the puck and when you were stick handling with it, you literally had to keep your stick on the puck the whole time. You couldn't just kind of shovel it ahead and skate onto her before you knew it was going to be in your skate. So I think that's exactly what happened with Keegan. Just kind of came around his net, got his head up to make an outlet pass, and the next thing you knew, the puck wasn't on his stick. And unfortunately, it ended up on the wrong guys because that Chaput was pretty good last night, and he buried it.
And speaking of burying it, I'm sure Keegan Lowe felt pretty good when Samuelson ripped that shot from the high slot to make it 4-3 shortly after the Shawinigan team tied it up.
Well, you know, Al, that just really typified what the Oil Kings have been all about this year is when they need a huge goal, they get it. When someone needs some picking up, someone on the team does it. And so, yeah, you're right. I mean, I don't even think Keegan Lowe had time to kind of let it sink in and realized how, you know, how big a gaffe that was because certainly they come back. Great pinch from Griffin Reinhart. Makes a beautiful pass to Stefan Legault, who one times it back for the one-timer from Samuelson. And, you know, obviously the guys on the bench are up cheering and, you know, giving Keegan pats on the back and on the head, and suddenly the Oil Kings have the lead. So, yeah, huge, huge goal.
Ken, you know from, you know, you've played hockey at a very high level, and you know that the road trip to the Memorial Cup, the strange beginning, I mean, you a round robin is so important, you don't lose any games. How huge is it for them to, and I mean, it wasn't a masterpiece, it was not a Rembrandt, but how big is it for them to win game number one?
Yeah, you hit the nail on the head. I mean, it's just massive. And, you know, more than anything, even talking with Coach Derek Laxtal this morning, like, you know, they got the win, and that was most important. It wasn't like they played the greatest game ever, but, you know, you're able to play the host team the first game. You get a sense of the atmosphere. You get a sense of your surroundings, what's going on. Now you've got that win under your belt. Well, rest assured that assures you probably to for surely at least play in the tiebreaker game on Thursday, but it gives you a little confidence going into game two. And if you lose that first game, that just makes game two that much more, pressure packed, where now they can go and play against London and or St. John and not necessarily be as stressed or as nervous as he would, because they've already got, you know, that win in the win column and off to the races.
Do they have enough rest, Kent? They got a day off, and then they'll practice tomorrow, and then they got back to back. Is that a schedule they can deal with? They won't be tired for the London game.
No question. They'll be fine. Just go back to last week, and they had to play in Portland, hop on a charter, and then play less than 24 hours later in Game 7 back in Edmonton. So, you know, they'll have, a nice day off here today, get some relaxing, go and get a good skate, good sweat on tomorrow. Back-to-back will not be a problem for these guys at all.
I'll admit I don't know a lot about London or St. John as teams. Obviously, Shawinigan was a very good team as well. Would you say the Oil Kings are at least as able defensively as any of the other teams in this tournament?
Oh, no question. No question. That Shawinigan team that you saw last night, they were the best defensive team in the QMJHL this past season. London was the best defensive team in the OHL. And so it's kind of interesting. You see the four teams here kind of built on defense first. Obviously, St. John has some huge firepower up front, but they were a very good defensive team as well. So there's no question that this Oil Kings team stands up, and it starts in goal. Laurent Bressois, there's been a lot of buzz about this guy already at this tournament. Turned in a fine performance last night. He'll only get better as this tournament goes on. So, I think the Oil Kings are certainly above the class in that category.
With Kent Simpson from Oil Kings, color commentator for our broadcast on Team 1260. I've noticed during this playoff run in the WHL and then obviously in the Memorial Cup, Kent, it seems like to me Griffin Reinhart is just improving and getting more confident in all areas of the game. Every time I see him, he impresses me, and he scored a gorgeous goal last night, ripped it from the left boards and carried the puck all the way through three zones to get there. This is a guy who must just be at the top of his game right now, and it's going to have huge impact on his draft number.
Oh, no question. And I think you're right, Al. And, his stock was rising throughout the regular season, and it's just continued to soar through the playoffs when scouts and NHL teams get to see, you know, how this guy performs under the biggest stage of all. And he's got such poise and patience with the puck. And, you know, that goal that he scored last night, that kind of demonstrated what else he's capable of. And, literally picks the puck up in his own corner, his own zone, goes end-to-end. He's such a big guy. When he gets going, he's actually pretty fast. But when he gets going, he's very good at kind of just using his body to shield off any attackers. So he comes across the blue line, gets his head up, and then just a laser beam of a wrist shot. And, that's just a kind of typical Griffin Reinhart. You think you've seen it all, and then he goes and does that. And it's kind of like, wow. you know, he can go end to end and top shelf too. So, you know, I'm sure there was a lot of notes being scribbled in scouts' notepads after that goal.
Change gears a little bit, Kent. We know that Tom Rennie has not been renewed by the Edmonton Oilers, and we've been discussing, you know, his time with the Oilers. This is a coach who came in as an assistant under Pat Quinn. They had a poor season under Quinn, and then the rebuild was underway, and his Rennie's, the idea under Tom Rennie was to improve as players, not necessarily worry about wins and losses. And no matter what happens after this, Tom Rennie should be credited with helping develop a lot of these kids. Talk to me a little bit about your experience with Rennie as a coach and how he was as a mentor and a teacher.
Yeah, I mean, I respect that guy so much. I just think he's an amazing coach. And, you know, I think a lot of it is what you said is you know, look at what Nugent Hopkins did his rookie year. Look at the way that Eberle's come along, Hall, those guys. You know, obviously, PRV took a little bit of a step back this year. There's no question about that. But, you know, even on the back end with some of their young guys, Petrie having a super year this year. So, and I think, you know, the Oilers staff didn't discount that. It was kind of, you know, they had some veterans. You heard Steve Tamley in the press conference say, you know, some veterans that had to step up as well. So, you know, I don't know if somewhere along the way that Tom lost those guys or what, but, you know, I'll tell you, there's not a guy that, you know, is more passionate about his players, about doing everything he can to, you know, empower them, to give them an opportunity to win, to give them confidence. And, so, you know, it's too bad. You know, I was hoping that he'd stick around and kind of see this rebuild through. But like you said, whoever takes over this team is going to be, I think, reaping the rewards of you know, the patience and some of the practices that he's preached over the last, you know, 2+ years.
Final one, and then we're going to let you get back to your day off here, Kent. Shawinigan, I admit I don't know a lot about Quebec. Shawinigan is how far is it from Montreal, and is it between Quebec City and Montreal? Is that where it is?
Almost exactly, yeah. So it's it was about 2 hours drive from Montreal to Shawinigan, or on the main highway that's for between Montreal and Quebec City. You'd get to Trois-Rivières first, mm-hmm. and then you just kind of take a left there, and it's probably about 25 minutes off the highway. You know, once you turn off at Trois-Rivières. So that's actually where the Oil Kings are staying, is in Trois-Rivières, just across the bridge of St. Lawrence River, just a nice little hotel that's a little bit away from kind of all the hub and buzz, you know, of the tournament. So it kind of gives the players an opportunity to get a little break and get away and rest. So that's it's a good setup.
Good stuff. Kent, thanks so much. Enjoy it. We'll be looking forward to hearing you your next game, obviously, on Monday.
Great. Thanks, Al. Have a great weekend.
All right. You too, bud. That's Ken Simpson, who joins us from Quebec and Shawinigan, Trois-Rivières area. And he will be broadcasting live Oil Kings and St. John Monday at 5 and then again on Tuesday at 5. And depending upon the results of all the Memorial Cup games, we'll definitely be hearing later on in the week. And we thank him for his time and pretty interesting comments on Tom Rennie, too. Ken and I have had a chance to talk about his experience playing internationally and under Tom Rennie, and a guy who obviously, as you can tell, had a great deal of respect for him. And I think Sean Horkoff mentioned that as well, that he really had an impact on these players, and it's disappointing. And as Kent said, the next coach will be reaping those rewards with all the hard work and the teaching done by Tom Rennie and his staff. Now, it's 1:19. We're going to take a break. Bruce McCurdy from Cult of Hockey will join us. We'll talk about Rennie, Sutter, the World Hockey Championships, and more. This is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
Don't forget, we have the NLL final today, 5:30, with Jason Greger, Rochester, and your Edmonton Rush right here on Team 1260. Stay tuned for that. I have an update for you. It's 2-0 now. The Rangers up on the New Jersey Devils, and just a few minutes left in the game. Dan Girardi and then Chris Kreider scoring for the New York Rangers. I still think it's going to be a Ranger-LA King final. That should be good. Honestly, I don't remember the last team that looked as good this long during the Stanley Cup playoffs is the Los Angeles Kings. They have that kind of look where, you know, they're going to be strong this year and next year. And I, from my point of view, I just have a feeling that the LA Kings are going to win it all. I'm going to go out on a limb. They went 10-1. Really, Al? Yeah, that's how I feel. I think LA is going to win this thing. Joined now by Bruce McCurdy from the Cult of Hockey. How are you, buddy?
Good, thanks. How about yourself, Al?
Well, I'm good. I'm good. Are you doing lots of hard work on the long weekend?
Well, if you call watching sports hard work, I do a lot of that, quite a lot of the time, actually.
Now, you're a little older than me, and I don't want to put you on the spot or anything, but doesn't it feel weird having a Saturday afternoon game and then no Saturday night game?
Well, it feels doubly weird when you realize that they're putting the Saturday afternoon game directly against the Champions League final. And this is the second week in a row the NHL has shot themselves in the foot by putting on a daytime game against direct competition. Last week it was the Canada-USA game at the World Championships that kind of got backburnered by some people, and other people, you know, didn't watch the NHL as a result of the clash. Like, they've got to be hurting their own audience. And I guess the Canadian audience and the Hockey Night in Canada window, that's of secondary importance. Or they've been chasing this American TV market for, what, 50 years now, as long as I've been watching.
Yeah, for sure. I remember reading in the hockey news, you know, CBS picks up contract, 6 games this year, and it was a big deal. Exactly. And that was like 1968. And it was
right after expansion, ever since.
Yeah, it's true. My thing is, I don't blame the city of Atlanta or its people for wanting to go outside on a beautiful day and not go watch a hockey game. There's lots to do. You know, you throw that puppy in Winnipeg during the winter time and everybody's going to the game. It just makes sense, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the Edmonton Oil Kings are up 1-0. That was a crazy game. What was your assessment of the video goal fiasco? Regwald wanted your input.
That was a complete fiasco. That's one of the worst calls I've not only ever seen but ever heard. To hear the comical exchange between the referee and the man upstairs, as they call him, they seem to be talking right past each other. I think they blew that, by my count, they blew that call 4 different ways. Fortunately, they didn't give Schwinnigan 4 extra points for each one of those mistakes, but that was a horrific sequence of blunders.
It reminds me of every conversation I've ever had with my wife. Same exact thing, you know? I'm saying one thing while she's talking, you know? And she doesn't hear me. So what are you going to do? How big of an item is winning that first game? I talked to Kent Simpson a second ago about the fact that that's a big game, but how big is it?
It's gigantic. I mean, first of all, from a historical perspective, Alan, that's the first win by an Edmonton Oil Kings team since 1966, when Al Hamilton and Jim Harrison, Ace Bailey, Ray Kanasiewicz's team beat Bobby Orr's Oshawa Generals in 6 games to win the Memorial Cup. The Oil Kings went back 2 subsequent times in the early 70s, and both times they lost both of their games. So they literally haven't won a game for almost half a century. So that's one thing. But within the context of the current tournament, to win a game in the round robin automatically assures you're in the playoff round. At bare minimum, if everything goes wrong, the Oil Kings will still be in a sudden death tiebreaker game next Thursday night. Not that they lose 2 games and the other team split the games in such a way that there's 2 teams with one win apiece. That's the worst that can happen already. Whereas Shawinigan is already facing, geez, we got to beat either London or St. John or we're out.
And then London, I mean, there's no weak link in this. I mean, I think Shawinigan was, you know, probably at a disadvantage because of the long layoff, but they're a hell of a team too.
They gave the Oil Kings everything they could handle last night. They had the advantage on the shot clock. I think Edmonton probably had the better goaltending, and that may have been the difference. I mean, the call made the score closer than it should have been in one respect, but it was a close game, and Oil Kings were, well, I think nervous, and it was the ice looked like it was pretty bad, and it was kind of a jittery game, I think, all the way around, refs included.
What I noticed was that the skill on the blue line for the Oil Kings really came to the fore. And I'm talking about Griffin Reinhart, but some really solid defensive play standing up on the blue line, Pesek as well. This is a nice group of defensemen the Oil Kings have.
They have 7 very passable defensemen. And the top 4 are mostly excellent. Keegan Lowe, I think he struggled last night quite a bit. But he's generally been a pretty solid player these last 2 seasons at least. And then Pesek is a rock on the blue line. He's a skill, slick, puck-moving guy in the manner of Tom Gilbert at his best. And when he's on top of his game, he plays that style of game. And Martin Gernat, the Oilers' draft choice, he's just progressed in leaps and bounds. I think they And I got a real steal with that pick in the fifth round, that this guy is looking like he might be a real NHL caliber, well, prospect. That's all you can call any of them at this point. But you can see some real upside with him. And then, of course, Reinhardt is slated to go top 10 in the NHL entry draft probably next month.
I was interested in watching Reinhardt this year. I remember Paul Reinhardt. I know you do, too. And what I had heard early on was that the scouts wanted him a little bolder, a little meaner. And he seemed to add that maybe, you know, in January, February. And you know, he's playing very confidently. This is a guy who maybe more than anybody, certainly on the Oil Kings, has improved his draft number based on his season and then his second season in the playoffs.
Yeah, he's picked up the physical game. I noticed quite a lot in the postseason. I got to all the home games but one, you know, for the Oil Kings, and Reinhardt was really stepped up the physical game in the Brandon and Moose Jaw series in particular. There was one game where he had three or four big hits, but more often, just sort of once in a while, he would come out of the blue and really crank somebody, and that would kind of set the tone for the rest of the night, kind of, you know, that the old Larry Robinson thing. Hit him once early in the game, then you don't need to do it anymore after that.
Yeah, they remember the Larry Robinson. Remember the Dornhofer hit where he broke the boards, I think?
Yes.
Oh, man. That's a classic. The other guy who's capable of rattling some boards is Samuelson, another Oil King draft eligible. That was a hell of a snipe from a big man last night. The scouts had to have noticed that.
Yeah, that was a beautiful finish, wasn't it? His hands are kind of hit and miss, and they certainly were in hit mode at that particular moment, but he's not a real natural puck handler, but he's a real, you know, slugger along the boards, and he'll grind it out all night long, and he's got a quite a mean streak in it. Of course, that he kind of that honestly being Ulf Samuelson's son. He got suspended four times this year in about under 50 WHL games. So obviously he doesn't quite know where the line is drawn at this point, but that's actually going to make him more of a desirable draft pick, having that kind of a resume, unfortunately, in one sense, that's the way teams think, hey, we need a mean guy, and two suspensions, hey, that's good. We'll file off those rough edges, and we'll be left with a masher.
So, well, from my point of view, you know, and it leads into my next question, he's the kind of guy Oiler fans have been maybe looking for from the Oilers, and I was sort of hoping he'd slide into the early second round, but with the year he's having in the playoffs, he might slide into the first round.
He's been hanging in those in the 30s throughout much of the year, and he actually dropped a little bit in some of the rankings after he came over from Sweden to Edmonton at the midway point. I tell you, watching the guy play up there, it's not hard at all to project some of the things he does with filling holes of some of the things Edmonton Oilers need. Because, you know, the Oilers have had that the lack of a big power forward, big mean power forward for a long, long time. And what Samuelson brings to the table is the sort of thing that Edmonton's looking for, whether they would choose that particular player. I'm sure they want a player like that.
Let's change gears a little bit, talk about some Oilers who are playing overseas at the World Hockey Championships. What is it about Canada and the quarterfinals? They had a flat tire again this year.
3 years in a row, and I felt bad for the four players in particular, two of them Oilers, Eberle and Dubnyk, and also Kane, Evander Kane, and John Tavares, that have gone 3 years running, all 3 years of their professional career. And in fact, Eberle went over the year before he was a pro. And each year they've looked good in the round robin. Last year they were undefeated. This year they won their pool, and then come the quarterfinals, and bang, something goes wrong. The last 2 years, they had a one-goal lead in the third period both times and lost it in the last part of the game. And it's the one game you just can't lose. And unfortunately, every year something seems to go wrong. This year, the Slovaks, you think they're an overmatched team, but they look like a team on a mission. They took out the Czechs today, 3-1. They're in the gold medal game, and I think they've all got a tattoo of Pavel Dimitrov's number 38 yeah. somewhere on their bodies, because they are playing an inspired game of hockey. Miro Chetan today was brilliant. 37-year-old former Oiler Miro Chetan was the player of the game.
He made that snipe on the goal he scored on. That was an impossible to stop and an impossible shot. It was perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So Hemsky was flying too for the Czechs. He didn't get a lot done, or at least when I saw the first two periods, he was flying around there. He and Peter Nedved, who's got to be 70. Hopefully that bodes well for the Oilers in the fall if Hemsky's playing like that in the spring.
Well, Hemsky, I thought he was getting his skating legs going down the stretch in the regular season for the Oilers, and he had a rough year, as we all know, and the shoulder probably had something to do with that, and the uncertain contract, and who knows what all motivates sometimes Alex Hemsky. He's a bit of an up and down player in some respects, but he played well down the stretch, and he had a super tournament for the Czechs. He had five goals, and he had
it's okay, we like dogs, don't worry about
yeah,
it, Bruce.
Yeah, we're walking away from the barking dogs, sorry.
We like dogs and kids on the show, Bruce. Never worry about that, buddy.
All right. Well, that was Dusty.
There you go.
Your cameo appearance. So, anyways, Hemsky, he was flying, and he was flying in the third period, too, and he was setting guys up. He was taking shots himself, and he was he seemed to be the straw stirring the drink for the Czechs. But they ran into a hot goalie and an inspired team, and you know, at least they're in the semis, so they have another shot at a medal. Tomorrow they'll play the Finns for the bronze.
The Russians look like they could actually take over the world. Their game this morning against Finland, it took them a while, but Malkin looks like he belongs in a higher league.
Yeah, I don't know where that guy is. That we won the scoring championship and the Electric Heart Trophy, and when I watched the series against Philadelphia, I was thinking, what happened to him? And then the good Malkin is back for these world championships. He's been sensational. I think he's had two hat tricks, and he's either tied or just pulled ahead of our man Patrick Thorsen in his scoring race at the world. 18 points. I don't know if Malkin had any assists today. Then I missed the early game. He got three goals. He had any assists. He's the full out scoring leader. But Thorsen had 18 points in 8 games. Another former Oiler. They're all over this tournament. Chetan and Nedved and Thorsen, they're all playing great.
I think Thorsen deserves another shot back here. What do you think, buddy?
I would love to see him back here. I liked him when he was here. I could never understand why they put him on waivers and let him get away the way they did when they were going nowhere that season. It didn't make any sense. And I can't see him returning to Edmonton just because of that, but I can see him in the NHL and being a very useful player over here.
Well, you know, and he did kind of hold up Toby Peterson's career, so that was why I think.
yeah.
Let's talk about Tom Rennie a little bit, not renewed. Are you surprised by it, and do you think the Oilers will end up getting a better or more qualified coach to make that next step?
Boy, I don't know about more qualified. Rennie's got qualifications out the yin-yang. You know, he's a career coach that, you know, he's got some pretty impressive things on his resume, even if it falls a little bit short of Stanley Cups and Olympic gold medals. He came as close as possible to one of those without taking one. I'm a little bit surprised that they waited and kind of left it for a month. I don't know what was accomplished by that. To tell you the truth, it just doesn't look good. I'm really kind of in the middle on the whole thing as to I'm keen to see obviously who they hire next, and ask me then if I think he's better than Tom Rennie, because I'd put Rennie somewhere in the sort of middle of the pack of competent NHL caliber coaches.
I agree. I think that the rumor is Sutter, and I think that's a sideways step, not to be critical of Sutter, but, you know, Tom Rennie, you know, he has a good resume. He was obviously a teacher. Do you think there's a possibility that the Oilers just wanted a little more of a hard ass coach without, you know, offending people by saying that? Do you know what I mean?
Yes, I do know what you mean. And that's often the rhythm in the NHL is you change coaches from a player's coach to a hard ass and back to another player's coach to try and get different responses out of the player. So that may be what they have in mind. Depending on how where they are in the process, what they say they're doing is beginning interviews with a series of guys. And presumably some of those guys are hard asses and some of them are not. So we'll see who actually emerges from the fray. And maybe there is a pre-favorite like Brent Sutter, who didn't get it done at the Worlds, but sounds like he made a positive impression with some people who might count.
Yeah, and I think that's exactly right. I think a guy like Hartikainen may benefit because of the aggressive forecheck and the work down low that Sutter likes to do. Would you agree with Hartikainen possibly being a guy who might benefit from a coaching move like that?
Well, I think just about all the Nordic players on the Oilers are going to be not unhappy to hear the change for whatever reason. And I don't think it has anything to do with Peter Forsberg in 94, but for whatever reason, Rennie and Swedes, it didn't seem to click with Pjärvi or with Omark, certainly, or with Lander got his chance, but he didn't really... He didn't survive the season, and I think it's a coincidence. Like I wouldn't for a second suggest that there's anything to where these guys come from. But at the end of the day, the Oilers have got a few players of European background that might be looking forward to a chance to impress a new coach.
Whenever we have Bruce on from now on, we're going to have something called Astronomy Minute. Because Bruce, although he's a fine writer and clearly knows his hockey and very knowledgeable about hockey's past and present and future, also knows a lot about astronomy and the stars. So, Bruce, is there anything shaking up there in the next few weeks and months that we can look forward to?
There are two really, really important astronomical events coming up in the next couple of weeks. And one is actually tomorrow, Sunday, from just after 6 p.m., until quarter past eight, we're going to experience a fairly deep partial eclipse of the sun.
Okay.
So that'll be visible in the... I like the music. That'll be visible in the western sky, of course, the setting sun. And the moon is going to pass across the lower half of the sun and take a more than 50% chunk out of it for by the time we get to the midpoint of the eclipse at 10 past 7.
Okay.
So the other huge event coming up is extremely rare is what's called the transit of Venus, which the planet Venus passed directly across the face of the sun on Tuesday, June 5th. And that event will occur from just after 5 in the afternoon, just after 4 our time, right through until sunset. The transit will still be underway. And that's an event, a partial eclipse. You'll get another one in your lifetime. The transit of Venus, if you miss this one, well, there's another one scheduled in 2117 that you might want to mark on your calendar. There's only ever been 6 of them observed in the history.
I'm gonna have to
this point. So it's just one of those things that doesn't happen very often. For both of those events, because both occur against the face of the sun, you need some kind of safe solar viewing protection.
Okay.
And that would either be a number 14 welder's glass, or it would be a pair of solar glasses such as the bonus pair that's included in the current issue of Sky News magazine that has details on these events, and eclipse glasses just for anybody looking. Or else you could go to a place where there are properly equipped telescopes like we have at the observatory at the Telus World of Science, and we'll be observing both of those events there if the weather's clear. And that's always the caveat.
Exactly. I was going to use Fireball XL5 music, but they wouldn't let me. Bruce, thanks for this. Appreciate it.
Okay, thanks very much. Always a pleasure, Alan.
All right, Bruce McCurdy from Cult of Hockey, and clearly a guy who knows his stars. And, you know, a couple of events there. I liked when he started talking about welder's glasses. You're knowing that the guy's really hardcore when he's getting into, you know, what you have to wear, and he wants to caution everybody. And anyway, we really appreciate Bruce's time, and he had some great input into the Edmonton Oilers and his thoughts on the coaching change. And I thought that he put it very well, Tom Rennie and his qualifications, and maybe a different style as opposed to more qualified. Maybe this is a case of the Edmonton Oilers want to go in a different direction about how, you know, they frame the issue going into the game and that sort of thing. Now, we're going to take a break. We're going to talk about Taylor Hall at center after the break. This is Nation Radio, brought to you by Edmonton Motors.
This is Nation Radio with Alan Mitchell, a.k.a. Low Tide. Presented by Edmonton Motors.
Only on Edmonton Sports Radio.
Team 1260.
Rangers defeated New Jersey 3-0. Girardi, Kreider, and Callahan, the goal scorers, are up 2-1. Game number four for Los Angeles, and Phoenix is tomorrow. They could wrap that series up, and then they're going to have a little bit of a layoff. And in the World Hockey Championships tomorrow, Slovaks against the Russians. That'll be interesting. I was going to talk about this, but we don't have a lot of time. It's on the Oilers Nation site. We're talking about moving Taylor Hall to center. That's what I'm talking about it. Everybody else is saying it's a crazy idea. So chime in there and defend me, would you? But just about the fact that Sean Horkoff is at a point in his career where maybe he's not going to be able to outscore the tough opposition with the difficult zone starts. Nugent Hopkins a little too young in his career. And the guy who had the best Corsi Rel compared to the rest of his team was Taylor Hall. And, you know, there's been talk, certainly Tom Rennie talked about it, maybe moving Hall to center. Never actually did that, but might be an idea. The new coach may look at that. So if you want to check it out, it's on the Oilers Nation site. Next Saturday, we're going to have more on the draft, and you can also give us your input. You can drop by Oilers Nation site, Low Tide site, as well as Low Tide _ on Twitter with your suggestions or guests you'd like to see on the radio between noon and 2 on Nation Radio. We would love to hear from you, and of course, your input is welcome. We will be draft heavy next weekend, I can tell you that, and our thanks to Corey Pronman for doing such a great, great job updating us on a lot of different prospects who are maybe outside the top 30 that you read about with Bob McKenzie and ISS, and the pipeline guys do a great job as well. Those _ guys like Jimmy Vasey and those guys are interesting to find out about at this time of the year, because as we get ever closer to draft day, we'll be covering that more and more on Team 1260. Don't forget the NLL Championship, 5:30 today with Jason Greger right here, Rochester and your Edmonton Rush. My thanks to Jonathan Willis from all sorts of places like Cult of Hockey and Oilers Nation as well. Bruce McCurdy from Cult of Hockey, Tom Lynn, player advisor, agent, and attorney. We appreciate his help. Corey Pronman, as I mentioned, and Ken Simpson. Don't forget, your Edmonton Oil Kings are in action on Monday at 5 against St. John and Tuesday at 5 against the London Knights, and we'll have those games and more for you from the Memorial Cup right here on Team 1260. I'm out. Have a great long weekend. Connor, he's good.